Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A few weeks ago, Maha Khanum asked me a question. Why did God create human beings? What was God's purpose for our creation? She immediately followed this question with a verse from the Holy Quran that essentially says God created humans to worship Him. Then she wanted me to elaborate on this Quranic verse, and I promised her to address this question in a sermon, which I will attempt to do today. As I was putting my thoughts down for the sermon today, initially I was very tempted to dive into the Holy Quran and pick some verses that can inform us on this question, why God created human beings. This is the customary practice in Islamic circles. Why did God create us? Then we point to some verses in the Holy Quran, and that would be the end of this story. But there is another angle to this question. Does God really have a purpose in His act? We rarely even think about this question, which precedes the other one. Does God really have a purpose in His act? This question, again, almost never comes up in our conversation. So I decided to talk about this missing element in our conversation about our own creation. Now, what I will share with you today may be new to many of you. Some may even have a hard time following what I say. Some may even become uncomfortable at times with what I will present. But I hope that at a minimum, my talk will inspire you to think deeper about God and His acts. This may even result in a paradigm shift for you, a new appreciation for God. And that would be my hope for my talk today, that my talk will inspire you to have a different appreciation for God. So let's begin. Why did God create us? What was His purpose? Well, there is an assumption embedded in this question. It assumes that God has a purpose in His act. He has motives for what He does. After all, we humans, you and I, have motives for our willful acts. When I plant a tree in my backyard, I have a purpose for doing it. It may be that I want to enjoy the view, or I want to eat the fruits from of that tree, or just I want to have a shade in my backyard. It is very difficult. It is very hard for most of us to fathom that God, the creator of the universe, did not have a purpose in His creation. He didn't have a purpose in His creation. This may even sound ludicrous to a lot of religious people. But for centuries, Muslim philosophers have argued that God does not follow human logic. What may sound perfectly logical for humans may not even apply to God. The point that Muslim philosophers raise is not academic, right? It's not an academic point that Muslim philosophers raise. It actually goes to the heart of our perception of God. Our perception of God, our theology, has a huge impact on how we live. Let me repeat one more time. our perception of God, how we perceive and conceive God, our theology, has a huge impact on how we live our daily life. A flawed view of God is very dangerous. Much of the awful things religious people do to themselves and others is rooted in a flawed theology. Let me tell you what the biggest flaw is in the ordinary view of God. And this ordinary view is prevalent in all religious communities. What is that flaw in theology? Viewing God as a supersized human. The average Muslim, Jew, and Christian perceives God as a human, but with infinite knowledge and infinite power. In other words, most religious people, at least in Abrahamic tradition, tend to attribute human qualities to God. Most of us think that God behaves like humans. This view, again, is very common in Abrahamic religious communities. We think, or at least we tend to think, that God gets annoyed if people do not offer appropriate worship or gratitude. God gets upset if people do not obey Him. He rewards those who follow His commandments. And what's even worse, a lot of religious people think that God is very opinionated. He has strong opinion on a wide range of issues. He even takes sides in political disputes. That's what we see in America today. God takes sides in political disputes. He even encourages people to wage war and kill others in His name. Orthodox Abrahamic belief states that God created Adam in His image, right? That's what we always say. Well, this is theory. In practice, most religious people end up recreating God in their own image. They project their own aspirations. They project what they like. They project their flaws to God. And that's what happens in practice in most Abrahamic communities when people recreate God in their own image. Now, you may ask, why is this flawed theology so prevalent among Muslims, Jews, and Christians? Well, it's partly because of their sacred scriptures. I can sense that some of you want to reach out of your webcams right now and punch me in the face for saying that. For saying that this flawed theology is partly due to the sacred scriptures of Abrahamic tradition. But please, bear with me, okay? Let me explain. Attributing human qualities, human characteristics to God is called anthropomorphism. It's a mouthful, anthropomorphism. Perhaps the height of anthropomorphism in the Abrahamic tradition is in Christianity, where God becomes a man, Jesus. That's the height of anthropomorphism in Abrahamic tradition. But the human-like God is also present in Islam and Judaism. So it's not limited to Christianity. The Hebrew Bible and the Quran are full of anthropomorphic descriptions of God. pretty much all the attributes of God in the Quran, with no exception, are human attributes. They are human qualities as well. Rahman, compassionate. Khaliq, creator. Hadi, guide. Ghafur, forgiver. These are some of the attributes of God in the Quran, and human beings can have the exact same attributes. We typically prefix these attributes with infinite when it comes to God. For example, we say that God is infinitely powerful, infinitely merciful, infinitely knowledgeable. But here is the point though, please pay attention. Assigning infinite to an attribute does not change its essence. When we say that human beings have limited knowledge, but God has infinite knowledge, the difference is in magnitude, not in kind. All we're saying is that God has infinitely more of the stuff that we human beings have. Now comes the other big question. Is it bad? Is it wrong that in the Abrahamic tradition, God is often described in human terms? Is it bad? Not really. Not really. Actually, it can have some good benefits. The anthropomorphic view of God works. It really works. It serves an important function. What is that important function? It allows the average person to relate to God. This anthropomorphic view of God allows the average person to relate to God. You see, we humans can readily wrap our mind around things that we have personally experienced. We have all experienced compassion, forgiveness, love. We have also created things, right? You and I, throughout our lifetime, have created many things. So when God is described in these terms, we can understand Him. We can relate to Him. Now, if I were to kick up this idea a notch and elevate it a bit more, I would say the following, and I'm sure Rumi would love this statement. When God appears in human life, when God appears in my life and your life, He takes on the attributes that the Quran mentions. Then we experience God as love, compassion, guide, provider, Ar-Razzaq. These are the impacts that God has on our psyche and consciousness. But, and here's the rub, describing God in human terms is just one side of the story in the Quran. There is another side to what the Quran teaches about God. And this second side plays a huge part in Islamic mysticism and Islamic philosophy. And I want to briefly explain what that second side, the second dimension in the Quran is. We typically recite Surah Al-Ikhlas in our daily prayers, every day. Most commentators believe that this short chapter is a rebuttal to the Christian view of God. The Christian view that God became a man in the person of Jesus. So Surah Al-Ikhlas is a rebuttal to this Christian perception of God. The whole chapter is about the absolute uniqueness of God. It attempts to sort of dehumanize God. So, from now on, when you recite Surah Al-Ikhlas in your daily prayer, I encourage you to zoom in on this central tenet and central idea in the chapter. This whole chapter is about the absolute uniqueness of God. What is the first verse in that chapter? قُلْ هُوَ اللَّهُ أَحَد. He, God, is one. What does it mean that God is one? It means God is absolutely unique. God is absolutely unique. God has no parallel in the created world. You cannot point to anything in nature and say, aha, that's God. Verse 11 in chapter 42 spotlights this idea. It sheds a lot of light on this idea that God is unique. لَيْسَ كَمِثْلِهِ شَيْءٍ. لَيْسَ كَمِثْلِهِ شَيْءٍ. There is absolutely nothing like God. Nothing in the created world is akin to God. Do not compare God to a human being. And unfortunately, that is exactly what most religious people end up doing. They compare God to themselves. They apply their own logic to God. They apply their own aspirations and shortcomings to God. Verse 159 in chapter 37 is even more insightful in this regard. This verse refutes what some polytheists, mushrikeen, said about God. This verse dispels some of the descriptions that polytheists had about God. Subhanallah amma yasifun. Very profound verse in the Quran. Subhanallah amma yasifun. God is far above what they attribute to him. God is far above what they attribute to him. Muslim philosophers, Muslim mystics correctly say that this verse is not limited to what polytheists attribute to God. It has a wider meaning. What is that wider meaning of this verse? Subhanallah amma yasifun. God is far above having attributes. God is far above having qualities or attributes. I think Imam Ali really understood the true implications of what verse 159 in chapter 37 says. Subhanallah amma yasifun. Imam Ali in Sermon 1 in Nahjul Balagha describes the height of Tawheed as a metaphysical idea. For Imam Ali, the height of Tawheed as a metaphysical idea is the following. كمال توحيده الإخلاص له وكمال الإخلاص له نفي الصفات عنه. The perfection of God's oneness is to regard him as pure. Pure of what? The perfection of God's oneness is to regard him pure, and the perfection of his purity is to deny him attributes. fascinating, wonderful. I can't say it, nobody can say it any better than Imam Ali. When you want to reach the height of Tawheed as a metaphysical idea, you will reach to a point where you will deny God of any attributes. So when we say God is pure, it really means God is pure of human qualities. That's why Ghazali correctly says, whatever we attribute to God must be understood as figurative, as metaphorical. Thinking, talking, mercy, and also purpose and motive, all these attributes are real for you and I. They are real for humans, but figurative for God. Let me repeat one more time. All the attributes that we typically assign to God, such as thinking, talking, purpose, motive, they are real for us humans, but figurative for God. The notion that God is free from human qualities also applies to creation. Now I'm going to go back to the point that I raised at the outset of my sermon. Did God have a motive, a purpose for creating us? Most of us have a human-like perception of how God created the universe. We assume that God had a motive and the purpose in creating the world and us. You see, you and I, when we create something, it is because we have a need. We need something, that's why we create. That is how we humans experience creation. Our motive is to have something that we do not have right now. So motive and purpose is tied to need. But if an entity, a being, has everything, then his actions are not dependent on motive and purpose. If an entity, a being, has everything, then his actions are not dependent on motives and purposes. God is such a being. God does not have any need. The word need does not apply to God. Here comes the second verse in Surah Al-Ikhlas. God does not have any need whatsoever. Allahu Samad. That's what we say every day in our daily prayers. Allahu Samad. God is eternally sufficient unto himself. Eternally sufficient. God is perfect and complete as he is. Everything is immediately present to God. This is an important statement that you find in most philosophical books on the nature of God. Everything is immediately present to God. God acts, God creates without actually needing anything. I know it's really hard for us to picture this scenario, that somebody would create without actually needing something. That's why our mystics and our philosophers tell us that we need a different lens to view God's acts and creation. We need a different lens to study God's creative act. You see, we typically have a very mechanical view of creation thanks to Greek philosophy. The perception that the vast majority of Muslims, and for that matter Christians, have of creation is really the Aristotelian notion of cause and effect. When we create, you and I, when we create something, our creation will be separate from us. For example, Dariush, he builds homes, he's a builder. When he builds a house, the house is external to Dariush. Now, this is how we picture God's creative act. The created world is on one side, and God, the Creator, is on the other side. And there is a huge gap, a huge divide between the two. The created world is detached from God, as if this universe parted with God. We do not see, typically, we do not see any intimate connection between God and His creation. So we have one God and trillions of entities besides God. Our mystics and philosophers say this is a bad way of describing God's relation to the universe. It's even shirk. Creation simply means manifestation. Let me repeat one more time. I'm going very fast. We don't have that much time, so please pay attention. This is how a mystic such as Rumi, Sana'i, Attar perceives creation. And for that matter, Mullah Sadra, perhaps the height of Islamic philosophy. Creation simply means manifestation, tajalli. Creation simply means manifestation, tajalli. When God creates, He appears. When God creates, He appears. Let me give you an analogy so that you can hopefully better picture what our mystics and philosophers such as Mullah Sadra attempt to articulate. I'm going to use the analogy of joy and smile. We typically think that joy and smile are two different things. Joy is the external cause of smile. But our mystics say that there is another way of looking at it. Smile is not the effect of joy. It is the phase of joy. When we are joyful, that joy is manifested in smile. Joy appears in the form of smile. Joy is formless. It doesn't have any form. But when it appears, we see it in the form of a smile. God is like joy. God is formless. The created world is like smile. God has assumed trillion of forms in creation. God has assumed trillions of forms in creation. Our mystics and philosophers like Mullah Sadra say that we should move away from the Aristotelian notion of cause and effect in creation. It is too mechanical. Instead, view creation like a spring or a fountain that just pours out. What happens when a spring or a well is full? It overflows, right? It overflows. That's precisely what Rumi teaches in Masnavi. Janj makhfi bud ze purri chak kard, khak ra taban tar az aflak kard. Janj makhfi bud ze purri joosh kard, khak ra sultan atlas poosh kard. God was a hidden treasure Because of its fullness, it burst forth and made the earth more shining than the heavens. God was a hidden treasure. Because of its fullness, it surged up and made the earth like a sultan robed in satin. So, when we want to understand God's creation, we should go beyond the ordinary human experience of creation. God does not think when he acts. This is another troubling assertion for many of you. God does not think. Thinking means that you don't know something. When you and I think, it's because we don't know something, and by way of thinking, we want to make it known. When you and I think, it's like moving something from the unknown column into the known column. But if someone knows it all, then there is no reason to think. God is all-knowing. There is no thinking involved in God's actions. I know it's very difficult to imagine how God acts and creates without thinking. So let me give you very quickly a few analogies from modern sciences. There are some 60 trillion cells in each of our bodies. Cells do not stop and think about what to do. If cells really thought about what they should do, it would create a mess. It would create a mess. Cells act without thinking. In an embryo, some cells work to produce a pair of eyes. Other embryonic cells form ears, heart, bones, so on and so forth. There is no thinking involved as we humans experience thinking. Embryonic cells just do. Let me give you another example. Energy. The energy in the universe. Energy doesn't think. Energy doesn't think. It just does. Energy creates, unfolds. It manifests in countless ways. Now, this may be a crude analogy, but God behaves like energy. He creates, unfolds, and manifests in countless ways. He doesn't think. He doesn't have motive or purpose either. If we view God in this way, our relation with God and nature will radically change. We will appreciate God in a radically different way. Let me close with one final thought. Perhaps, we should ditch the question, why did God create us altogether? We should not even raise this question, why God created us? God, as I mentioned, has no purpose because he has no need. The question we should really ask is, what should be our purpose in life? What should be our purpose in life? And inshallah, next time, I will address this question. As Muslims, what should be our purpose in life? And what does the Quran teach on this question? Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.